Welcome to the Right to Track podcast, where we aim to get the hard facts about the human rights challenges facing us today. I'm Todd Landman. In today's episode, we're asking, what is the relationship between business and human rights? My guest is Professor Shireen Hertel. Shireen is Associate Professor of Political Science in the Human Rights Institute at the University of Connecticut. She has conducted fieldwork in factory zones along the U.S.-Mexico border, in Bangladesh's garment manufacturing export sector, among NGO networks in India, and the multilateral trade arena. She is author and editor of Human Rights in the United States, Economic Rights, Conceptual Measurement and Policy Issues, and Unexpected Power, Conflict and Change Among Transnational Activists. So welcome, Shireen. It's nice to have you here on this episode of The Rights Track.
It's great to be here.
So you're joining us from Connecticut, where you're a professor and have been working at the Human Rights Institute. And your current work is about this relationship between business and human rights. But you've been on a bit of a journey to get there. And I'm really curious about asking you, what's the journey that got you to this topic? What are the sorts of things you've been working on all these years?
I am a bit of a non-conventional professor because I spent a good long time in the field, getting my feet very dirty, working in multiple places in the developing world and in the U.S. in the manufacturing sector periodically, looking at this issue of labor rights at the very local level and then economic rights and poverty more generally. I worked with the Ford Foundation and the United Nations Women's Fund and the UN Development Program, the UNDP, in a range of places. And much of my work at that time focused on poor people's struggles to get decent work, have work that was going to not only afford them the resources they needed to take care of their family, but also protect them from outright abuse at the workplace. And as an academic, I've really carried forward this line of inquiry, looking at individual people's stories as I looked at how they and their neighbors and friends and coworkers organize themselves to make demands on the business leaders, to make demands on people in government, to really seek to improve their life chances. And this work really amounts to an inquiry into social movements. So social movements are collective challenges where more than one person decides I've had enough and I'm going to really either through protest politics or strategic negotiation try to improve my lot in life. And so moving from this very local work, working with poor people, to stepping back a little as a professor once I transitioned out of the field and into the ivory tower, has been very interesting because I've analyzed the way in which economic rights have emerged as a real source of concern for folks around the world and have pushed Americans to think differently about what human rights equal. So for the United States average person, many, many folks think of human rights as things like protection from torture or the right to vote or the right to freedom of expression. But in many, many parts of the world, especially those where I've done research, people are also equally, if not more, concerned about the right to food or the right to work under decent conditions. And so I've looked at how social movements change our understanding of human rights and how often that happens when we learn to listen to what's happening at this very local level in the developing world.
That's great. So there's a whole history about rights and the way in which rights are made. And a lot of guests have talked about the international law of human rights and the articles and the instruments, etc. But in many ways, what you're telling me here is that rights are made. There's actually a struggle for rights. There's a demand for rights. And then oftentimes in places where rights are not protected, the demand to have rights can often yield rights protections from states and from the international community in ways that hadn't been thought before. So in a sense, there's a kind of a making of rights that you're telling us about.
Absolutely. And I think that if we look at history, I know Samuel Moyne, the historian at Harvard, has argued this very centrally. We often push beyond what we think rights might be. I know that Nottingham is doing wonderful work around the history of anti-slavery movement. In our own lifetimes, Todd, we've seen radical shifts in what rights are considered to be. Gay rights, the emergence of gender identity, and the right to freedom of expression of one's own sexuality weren't even imagined even 50 years ago. And so I think one of the exciting things I look at is this intersection between demand making, rights claiming, and then shifts in international law and practices to really make it possible for rights to emerge and rights to burgeon.
So how do you get into that narrative? You were talking about the stories that people tell, about interviewing people, about learning about their involvement in making demands. How do you do that?
Well, there are a couple of different ways. One is simply by literally going down to the ground level and talking to people. In the U.S., we have to get pretty significant clearance to make sure that we don't put anyone we speak to at risk. And so you design a survey. It can be very long and detailed, or it can be a series of guiding questions. And often in my case, I'll go to a community and spend quite a bit of time there also doing what's called participant observation, just watching how people's work lives and community life unfolds. And then I engage in pretty structured interviewing. Usually it's within an hour because poor people don't have a lot of extra time. They're working very hard. They're often working to make ends meet on multiple levels. And so I will do quite a lot of research that focuses around asking questions about life histories and the evolution of a campaign, for example, to, in the case of my research in India, demand better delivery of the free food that the government has available, but that's often lost in graft or corruption. Then I also often will look for other sources that can corroborate the stories I'm hearing. So I don't want to just rely on what people tell me because people can bend the truth to suit their own interests and needs. And so I'll often look for things like newspaper articles, stories by other organizations that will talk about the NGO or the non-governmental organization struggles. And I'll do work that is in some ways archival, where I'll start to code articles against key terms. We can do lots of really exciting research in quantitative research to code vast numbers of articles to really build out that narrative and look at how other people are talking about those struggles. I'll also often look at archival materials that non-governmental organizations or labor unions or others maintain in their archives. And so taking a look at how organizations represent their own struggles, either in their websites or in their historical documents, is another really helpful way of building that story out. And then finally, I do a lot of talking to other academics who are researching similar or parallel movements to get a sense of how they're reading the landscape as well. And so it's this triangulating between qualitative and quantitative and archival data that I find really stimulating and that helps me tell a fuller and more accurate story of the evolution of these kinds of struggles.
So you have the story and you're talking about the evolution of the struggle. And there's this very famous problem in social science called the logic of collective action or the problem of collective action. So you might hear people talk about demanding to change their right situation or get access to work or better working conditions, etc. But one person alone may find that difficult. And as you said, you talked about collective struggles and social movements. But this theory suggests that because people's individual participation in a collective event might be a bit limited. They might think that, well, my individual contribution won't make a difference. Someone else will do that for me. There's no incentive for me to get involved. So how did you learn how people stay involved? They discover the incentives to be involved in collective action. What contributes to a successful movement for rights?
I think that's an extremely good question because one of the big challenges for any social movement is sustained engagement. As I mentioned earlier, poor people are exceptionally busy. They have lots on their plate, not food necessarily, but lots of responsibilities and demands on their time. And so one of the things that it contributes enormously to successful social movement organization is often honestly training and support from allies of the movement. So middle class people, allies within government, international allies across borders can do a number of things to help those movements succeed. They can tell their story to funders and donors who can help support the movement's activities with very basic things like contributions so that if folks gather for a protest march, there's food available. They can be their allies vis-a-vis the legislature and writing some of the legislation that the group might hope gets passed to protect their rights. And they can be their allies vis-a-vis the courts to take a class action kind of suit forward so that it's not just one person trying to deal with a Byzantine court system, but rather a group of people whose interests get represented in a class action suit. That's very common in parts of the world where the Constitution actually provides for economic rights, like in India. There's also a real need to manage and take stock of many petty rivalries that exist within social movements. Not all folks in social movements are saints. They're just like the rest of us. And so one of the big challenges is keeping channels of communication open and making sure that petty rivalries and grudges don't overwhelm the movement. And that is a really serious challenge. Social movements provide lots of resources and PR and attention, and sometimes people will jockey for position or power internal to those movements. And so one of the things that allies can help with is mediating conflict internal to networks. Sometimes there's a tension internal to networks as well between people who are reformist and willing to work within existing structures of power, be they a labor union or a legislature, and people who are very radical or revolutionary and just want to overturn the status quo. And so sometimes this business of negotiating is also very important as allies help the movement think through its short, medium, and longer term range goals and decide how it's going to spend its precious resources, both in terms of people, but also in terms of political capital.
So you've learned all this about, you know, the various stories, the collective demands, what led to success and failure, some of the rivalries and internecine strife, etc. So how does all this apply to your current work on business?
So I think this is a very appropriate kind of connection, because for business and human rights struggles, average people in the workers' life will often be quite eager to work in a factory, especially in the developing world, where those jobs will pay more than informal sector work or work that's untaxed, unregulated, selling food on the streets or cleaning someone's house. A factory job looks pretty good. And there's often competition for even getting those initial entree to those types of jobs. But once a person has that type of employment, they will often find out it's not as wonderful as they might have thought outside the factory gates, that the pressures for production are pretty high, that the turnover may be extreme, that there may be health or safety issues, or that the pay might be better but lower than enough to sustain them. And so that's at the point at which folks will often think about how to negotiate. And it's far easier to do so collectively than it would be as one individual complaining about bathroom breaks or the lack thereof, or inability to get adequate attention for maternity leave or benefits. And so one of the things I've been very intrigued by in this business and human rights arena is the United Nations and international donor agencies saying workers' rights are human rights, and that community members themselves, even if they aren't members of the factory's employment pool, nonetheless have a stake in the degree to which the company produces living wages for its workers and pollutes or doesn't, and that we as consumers on the other end, all of the products we bring in from places like China or Bangladesh, also have a responsibility to pay enough for those products and to ensure that they're safe and well made, so that we too are part of the solution, not the problem of a race to the bottom where wages and working conditions continue to go lower, not higher.
So do you focus on any particular sectors? Because obviously working conditions in the extractive industries versus garments versus final end assembly will be very different, and the obligations will be different, supply chains are different, the level of complicity and responsibility, etc. All those things seem to vary quite a lot across those sectors. So which sectors have you been working in?
So what I've done most recently is assess the Business and Human Rights Resource Center's very large 6,000 company data set. And this is an enormous resource for both activists and academics alike. And I've parsed that big set of records on who's doing dialogue with communities and workers, and in which sectors is it most evident if we use a business and human rights framework. And we find it's a lot more evident in the extractive sector, in part because mining or oil companies have to get resources out of the ground in one place. And in order to do so, they have to talk with that local community if the indigenous people take over the mine or if folks attack the oil well. It's far less common, we've found through this assessment of the big data set, in the light manufacturing sector. And so that's actually where I want to focus my work in this area, is on thinking through the incentives to create a shared incentive for dialogue in the light manufacturing sector. In this day and age, Todd, we can move a factory for garment production or other light manufacturing incredibly quickly. You can create a factory and have business rolling out, but then decide you don't like the demands for wage increases or you're not happy with the community members, and you can container up that entire factory, barcode all your inventory and put it in a big shipping container, and move it from Mexico to Vietnam within a matter of a couple of weeks. And that creates a really bad incentive for dialogue with workers or communities, because if I don't want to bother with you, I can just move. And so the business and human rights framework gives companies a greater incentive to to engage, because this is about shifting their own image. Rather than be seen as sweatshop producers, a business and human rights framework makes being socially responsible part of their own company narrative. We know there's a sunk cost for building an oil well or extracting minerals out of the ground, and companies have to engage in dialogue in those settings, but there's far less sunk cost in setting up a lower tech, fast-moving light manufacturing sector. And so this is why I think that the business and human rights framework is one that's going to be vital to changing the nature of the incentives for these kinds of dialogues in that sector. And that's the place I want to look most explicitly in my research.
So what are the levers you've got? I mean, if I set up I want to put together a electronic product, I set up a little assembly factory somewhere in the Mexican border, the Maquiladora zone, and that doesn't go well for me, I suddenly move to Vietnam, as you say. What's the incentive for me to stay in Mexico and really address the local issues there? I'm struggling to see how the human rights framework helps here, because the company could just say, thanks very much, I go to Vietnam and start again.
Exactly. And that's precisely what's been happening. And that's why I think when we've looked at these 6,000 records, we find almost no dialogues happening in light manufacturing, because at this point in time, there's very little incentive. There is a sort of hope in the darkness, which is collegiate manufacturing. Students in the college and university setting tend to be pretty passionate about human rights issues. And so in the 2-3% of the global garment market that is collegiate apparel out of the entire garment sector, there tends to be a higher level of social responsibility. And there tends to be a greater predisposition to negotiate, because those companies that are marketing product to college students don't want to end up on the front page of the New York Times for sweatshops, because students will rally and demand better conditions. And so the innovation in light industry probably will start in smaller companies, many of them that are seeking to differentiate themselves from the vast number of competitors in that sector. And so one example I've talked about with folks before is Alta Gracia. This is a living wage factory in the Dominican Republic that's marketing itself explicitly to the collegiate market and produces hang tags right on the garment with the face of the worker and his or her personal story as a part of the marketing ethos of that company. And so the interest in companies differentiating themselves along these social responsible lines will often be about developing niche marketing. We see it certainly with Patagonia, the apparel manufacturer that's dealing with an exceptionally high level of environmental responsibility and marketing around that. And so my hope is that you can begin to create, through changes in companies' own brand image, an interest in telling us more about their social responsibility. Right now in the United States, the only requirements for labeling of a garment are that you have fabric content, washing instructions, and point of origin, but nothing about how the product was manufactured, the conditions under which labor took place. And so Alta Gracia adding this hang tag with a worker's story is a real innovation, because by law, there's no requirement to tell anything about the labor conditions.
What's the sort of market response to this, in the sense that I get the branding proposition? You can step out as a company like The Body Shop, for example, tried to do this with its branding and its supply chain. Starbucks ran into some trouble and then kind of turned its ship around by talking about its supply chain and its fair trade and et cetera. Other companies have done this, et cetera. But does the consumer express any willingness to pay a little extra for a fair trade product, or pay a little extra for something that has this special conditions attached to it? So there's an appetite, you know, a bit like free range eggs. You know, do you pay a bit more for a dozen eggs because you know it comes from the free range versus a factory hen? Are you seeing similar things happening in the business world with respect to those companies that are seeking out that sort of extra human rights kudos?
Yeah, I've been very fortunate to work on public opinion surveys in the United States. In 2006, 2008, and 2009, colleagues at University of Connecticut and I conducted national public opinion surveys, several thousand respondents by region and gender and age and income disaggregated, to be very, very diverse. And we found that over that period in time, which coincided with one of the biggest downturns economically in the United States history, well over half the population surveyed across the United States expressed a desire to consume ethically. They were willing to pay more for fair trade coffee and sweatshop-free clothing. And that was found to be pretty consistent over the three-year survey period, as well as one of the most exciting things for us was finding that consumers who care about these issues want demonstrated ways to show that their willingness to pay more actually redounds to the worker. That if I'm willing to pay 25 cents more for this sweatshirt, or as you say, for the eggs, the worker will actually benefit. And that interest in seeing a concrete solution trumped their age, their income, their gender, their racial background. And so I think we're hungry at this point for a business, very practical business and human rights solutions that tie this beyond niche marketing to changing the way we think through making consumers aware and empowering them through their purchase.
So it's a really interesting combination of factors there. There's the sort of moral argument, there's the sort of culture shift, there's the demographic shift and the kind of change in preference structure among the demand makers, if you will, or the demand within a consuming economy. And at the same time, it seems on the flip side, there's an advantage or a kind of commercial advantage for a company that adopts good human rights standards and then markets itself as a company that does that. So there's a virtuous set of processes here that could actually take human rights away from just making a moral argument to making a strong business argument for why it's good business to do good business.
Absolutely. And I think that my work echoes some of the most exciting research that's been done by people like Richard Locke, who's the provost of Brown University, but for many, many years conducted a big research program at MIT, the Massachusetts Institute of Technology, surveying thousands and thousands of companies themselves on how they audit their supply chains and finding really strong links between productivity and product quality and better human rights conditions. And so I think you're also seeing less turnover, less error rates, far better worker productivity than when we're not working in sweatshops than we would otherwise.
This is great. And so just finally, I'm curious how all of this work feeds into the larger international, somewhat more abstract work on what are called the RUGI principles for business and human rights and the UN Global Compact. How does your work feed into those agenda items?
It's very directly connected because John Ruggie's work has been pretty pathbreaking in saying we have plenty of treaties, ILO conventions, UN treaties on the rights of the child, hundreds and hundreds of corporate codes of conduct. So we have lots of law on paper, but very little space for companies, communities, workers, and advocates to sit down and hammer out the practical side of how we want to improve the landscape for business and human rights. Ruggie has three basic principles. One is that companies should respect the basic law. We know there's plenty of it that exists. Governments have to ensure that that law be enforced, and that there needs to be a remedy for people who are ill affected, whether they be on the shop floor or in the community. And stakeholder dialogue, or dialoguing between all of these different people who have a stake in business and human rights, is, I would argue, key to ensuring that those remedies get fairly adjudicated and fairly implemented. And also creating for business, as you said, a virtuous circle of enhancing their profits by improving their human rights practices. So the remedy is as much to enhance companies' stake in having a conversation with their workers and the communities where they do business as it is for workers themselves. I think there's been less attention paid to how to empower people within communities to know how to negotiate. And I think that's an exciting area that, because I've worked quite a lot on community development and the links between social mobilization and community capacity building, might be a really exciting new frontier for work around the RUGI principles. There are plenty of businesses that have glommed onto the RUGI principles and are very excited about making business and human rights part of their bottom line. But I think community members sometimes stand at the sidelines a little bit because they wonder if this is all just PR. Is it greenwashing? Will they really benefit from having a conversation with businesses? And I think that's what I'm most interested in looking at in this current research I'm doing, looking at specific companies that have engaged in this light manufacturing sector in dialogue and engaging with the communities to feel out their receptivity to that overture.
I think this is great because there's global skepticism about the human rights movement. There's a lot of skepticism about business and human rights. There's a worry that all these things are just abstract principles. And today you've really shared your own story of research, but also the pragmatic lessons you've learned by studying real, you know, grassroots movements, real people with real struggles for real stuff, and the ways in which those collective struggles have articulated a set of demands and rights claims, and at the same time, the ways in which there are pragmatic, almost economically based goods that can come out of a human rights focus from business, so that we go beyond that question of greenwashing and have real pragmatic solutions to some of these difficult problems. And I think that little bit that you ended with about the communities on the sidelines beginning to have dialogues and seeing the benefits themselves is the key challenge. And you know, with your research, you're actually addressing that key challenge. So I really, really thank you for being on this episode of The Rights Track. You've given us great insight into many different facets of social struggle around a particular set of rights, but also a key actor, business, and how that might change the world for good. So thanks for joining us today on The Rights Track, Shireen.
Thank you, Todd.
This episode of The Rights Track was presented by Todd Landman and produced by Chris Garrington of Research Podcasts. The podcast project is funded by the Nuffield Foundation, and you can find additional information and resources at www.rightstrack.org.